pointed this out not entirely frivolously, was it allowed the emergence of products that could be fermented to create alcohol. And this historian has suggested, I wouldn't press this too far, but it's sort of fun. This historian has suggested that one of the reasons that men were willing to adopt agriculture, despite the fact that it took them away from the hunt, was because it allowed them to get bombed. And indeed, we will see early on that some of the first things agricultural societies did, for example, with the introduction of writing, was to write down recipes for the fermentation of grain. Okay, more systematically and more seriously, agriculture allowed, as we've already suggested, a significant improvement in food supply that in turn allowed families to have more children, slash probably engage more frequently in sexual activity, and certainly allowed populations to expand. Whereas the population of the world at the eve of agriculture was probably at most 10 million people, quite possibly fewer than that. Within a few thousand years, the human population around the world had risen to 100 million or even more, and some of the great agricultural societies would be poised for population figures even in advance of these levels. Agriculture did not produce world populations at the level we're accustomed to today, but they generated populations that were vastly larger than had been true in the human condition up to that point. Agricultural societies, agricultural economies, always had some limitations. And as we begin to turn to a long period of human history, between about 9,000 BCE until literally 300-400 years ago, a long period, it's important to remember that these conditions will be true to some degree almost everywhere, except in those cases where agriculture didn't prevail at all. We've already seen some limitations, or at least some characteristics, in terms of gender relationships, relationships between parents and children. Okay, as agriculture families moved to birth levels that would usually involve a desire for between 5 and 7 children born for a family. Right? Agricultural economies also always were constrained by limitations in the amount of food that a given agricultural worker could generate. Except in a very few hothouse regions, even the most advanced agricultural economies, even 500 years ago, as recently as 500 years ago, required about 8 agricultural workers for every 10 people in the population. In other words, agricultural economies, although they greatly facilitated food supply, were always constrained by the extent to which 80% or more of the population had to be engaged primarily in agriculture. And this is important to remember. It's a constraint even on societies whose achievements we will soon marvel at. A constraint because it limited the amount of taxation that could be levied. It limited the size of cities to 20% of the population at the most, and frequently less than that. Russian Agricultural Society, for example, only in quite modern times generated an urban level that was more than 10% of the population. This constraint of resources, this constraint in terms of growing patterns, is a crucial feature to remember about agricultural societies generally. Agricultural societies would also, understandably enough, generate some cultural emphases. I think it's probably forcing it to say agriculture immediately produced an appropriate cultural response, because polytheistic systems that had been developed in hunting and gathering societies continued into agricultural societies for a considerable period of time. But obviously, over time, agriculture would encourage new attention to the spring season as the planting season, new attention to divine forces responsible for creativity. So you need to look, along with resource constraints and family patterns, one needs to look to agriculture as a set of cultural parameters as well, and that will crop up in our later discussions also. The crucial feature of agriculture, along with the drawbacks that have to be remembered, the crucial feature of agriculture was its capacity to lead to population increase and its capacity to generate not massive, but discernible surpluses, which could be used for purposes other than agriculture itself. Agriculture indeed imposed some needs for some people who could be at least partially freed from agriculture proper in order to do some other things. Most obviously, for example, agricultural societies depended on the development of manufacturing of certain kinds of containers that could hold food and seed from one season to the next. So not surprisingly, although this isn't immediate, one of the first areas where agricultural societies generated technological advance was in the area of pottery making, because you needed these things simply to maintain your agricultural economy. So without overdoing the progressive emphasis, because again the drawbacks have to be remembered, agriculture is involved with population growth, the generation of surpluses, and this could lead, and this is our point in the next session, this could lead to yet additional developments in the human experience, including cities, including other kinds of technological advance, and that could be, as we will discuss, the next stage in the story.
Lecture 3. What is a civilization?
The focus of this session is on the emergence of civilization as a form of human organization and the early civilization period in world history, which runs variably in the region roughly from 3500 BCE to about 1000 BCE. I want to talk about what civilization involves, why it's worth attention, but I'm also going to be talking about some of the possible pitfalls in over-reliance on the civilization concept. Some world historians are quite nervous about too much emphasis on civilization, and while I think ultimately we can take their concerns into account without throwing away the concept, it really is important to pay some attention to some of the drawbacks, both in civilization itself and in the concept. First thing to note, pretty obviously, is that in the Middle East, where civilization first emerged, it took about 5,000 years between the advent of agriculture to the first arrival of civilization. Now, before that time, agriculture had already permitted the development of certain isolated cities, usually with populations of 10,000, maybe a few more people. So there were some precursors. But it's important to realize that agriculture did not quickly or inevitably lead to what we're talking about today. Indeed, there were agricultural societies, for example, in West Africa, that reached the modern period without forming the apparatus that we associate with civilization. So, again, caution against too much inevitability, too much triumphal march of progress. The advent of civilization in the Middle East was preceded by some technological developments in addition to the maturing of agriculture itself. Most notably, by around 4000 BCE, people in the Tigris-Euphrates Valley, Mesopotamia, were beginning to utilize bronze for weapons and tools. And they were utilizing the wheel, which probably had been developed by nomads in Central Asia, but was brought in as part of migration streams. The use of bronze obviously improved military and production capacities. It also imposed certain other kinds of requirements on the societies that used the metal, because now societies, to take advantage of this, had to seek out both copper and tin, the amalgam that would make bronze. And tin sources actually could be quite remote, forcing a good bit of long-distance trade and travel, another feature that would mark this early civilization period. The first specific civilization to emerge, again in Mesopotamia, was Sumeria. It would be followed over the next several thousand years by a whole succession of states: Babylonia, the Hittites, the Assyrians, the Chaldeans. The list is quite long. because this was a region that was open to considerable invasion, and the attractions of civilization drew peoples, particularly from the north, from Central Asia, who came in as a mixture of migrants and invaders to take advantage of what civilization had to offer. This first civilization, this prototype of early civilization generally, offered a number of features that agricultural societies without civilization lacked. First of all, pretty obviously, it benefited from more abundant surpluses in agricultural production. And some historians really would like to leave it there. Civilizations are simply agricultural societies that have particularly large surpluses, and let's not get into the other characteristics that can seem misleadingly precise and progressive. But in point of fact, because again, I think civilization is a valid concept with caution, Sumerian civilization not only involved unusually large agricultural surpluses, but several other features that really were significant as forms of human organization in contrast to agricultural economies that were not civilized. Feature number one was the introduction of a formal state, a formal political apparatus, not only with leadership, which could emerge even in hunting and gathering societies, but with a certain degree of structure, a certain small but definite bureaucracy, judges, tax collectors, that sort of thing. So civilizations are stated societies rather than stateless societies, which agricultural societies had been previously. Second, and this is the origin of the word in Latin, civilizations had cities. As I've mentioned already, they weren't the first to have cities, but they depended more on cities than agricultural societies without civilizations did. Cities meant concentrations of people, small by our standards, but definitely concentrations that could facilitate other kinds of cultural exchange, technological development, etc. Cities also quite obviously depended on more elaborate trade than agricultural societies had required before this denser urban network. So cities had to make arrangements with the countryside for food supply. They often traded with other cities. You see the emergence of a small but definite merchant class, another characteristic of the apparatus of civilizations, more pronounced than agricultural economies without civilizations. And civilizations, beginning with Sumeria and its cuneiform style, civilizations had writing. Writing allowed record keeping. It goes along with bureaucracies. Writing allowed long-distance communication in standardized forms. It could therefore accompany the expansion of trade. Writing would ultimately affect the generation and preservation of knowledge. So civilizations normally are defined as agricultural societies, although you will later have industrial civilizations as well, agricultural economies with unusually large surpluses, states, cities, and more elaborate trade, not trade by itself, because other societies could do that, and writing. Older definitions also mentioned the importance of monuments, but that's really something of a variable and I think is a little bit superficial. Okay. Early civilizations developed first, obviously, in Mesopotamia, and then a procession of civilizations, some of which expanded empires in the Middle East. Civilization also emerged in Egypt along the Nile. From about 3000 BCE onward, although recent discoveries suggest maybe a little earlier. Civilization also emerged in the northwestern section of the Indian subcontinent in what's now Pakistan, along the Indus River, in a civilization that's sometimes called Harappan, from Harappa, one of the major cities involved. And a little later, Harappan civilization originated around 2500 BCE, a little later, civilization emerged in a fourth center in Asia, along the Yellow River or Huanghe in northern China. Some historians also point to the first civilization in Central America, Olmec, a little later still, as another early civilization type, although not in fact along a river valley and obviously somewhat more separate in origin and nature. The fact that these early civilizations clustered along river valleys, at least in the Afro-Eurasian cases, The fact that these early civilizations clustered along river valleys was no accident. River valleys provided the most abundant opportunities for agriculture, therefore the most promising opportunities for surplus. But these areas also, to take maximum advantage, required the use of irrigation systems that, in turn, depended on a good degree of coordination, possibly some property definition. In other words, encouraged a situation in which governments and formal rules and regulations, as well as increased trading opportunities, would make sense as well. Okay, I mentioned earlier that historians get a little nervous about the civilization concept, and I want now to say why, not because I think these objections should cause us to jettison the concept, but I think they do cause us to surround it with a certain amount of caution and complexity. Objection number one harks back to comments I made in the first session. There is a version of the civilization story, sometimes associated with the Western civilization teaching tradition, that is pretty obviously objectionable to world historians, easily fixed, but it's worth mentioning. This is the version that, again, as we're doing today, emphasizes the importance of civilization, points particularly to Egypt and Mesopotamia, and then uses this to posit the origin of a glorious tradition that would pass from these early cases to Greece and Rome, to Europe, etc., etc., etc. Now, from a world historian standpoint, the problem with this view is twofold. First, it ignores the fact that important early civilizations also developed in other places. So, easily fixed, if we don't single out this particular tradition as unique or somehow particularly glamorous, we can go back to the civilization concept without harm. But it is important to make that adjustment. The second objection really applies to the issue of heritage. Even if we focus attention on Egypt and Mesopotamia, it's obviously vital to recognize, and almost self-evident, that this tradition would not only feed Greece and Rome, but would also feed later Middle Eastern civilization, East European civilization, elements of African civilization. So the notion of marching, as sometimes grade school texts imply, the notion of marching from the pyramids to the Empire State Building as some sort of distinctive, singular tradition just doesn't cut it. Again, we can fix this, but we need to recognize that you need to shift point of view. The second objection to the civilization concept, or at least the second thing that requires attention, and this is not unrelated to comments we made earlier about agriculture. It's important to recognize that much of the world, particularly in this early period, most of the world, did not adopt the civilization form. Even later, what do you do with cases like Polynesian society, an agricultural society that had a definite social structure, elements of a state, but no writing, no particularly vigorous cities? It's an interesting society. It doesn't quite make the most elaborate definition of civilization. What do you do with it? Or even take the case of the Incas in the Andes in the 14th and 15th centuries CE. The Incas are usually regarded as a civilization, and that's fine, but in fact they didn't have writing. They had a system of record keeping by tying knots in ropes that would allow them to keep tabs on taxes paid, but technically they had no writing, so do they fit or not fit? Okay, so it's important to realize that civilizations, particularly again in the early period, were not the only kind of interesting society. They obviously did not spread to areas where hunting and gathering or nomadism prevailed, because those systems cannot generate the organizational forms associated with civilization. But even in important agricultural cases, civilization simply did not catch on, for whatever set of reasons. Okay? Third objection is really an interesting attachment to the way civilized peoples fairly early on regarded themselves, and that's the contrast between civilization and barbarism. As is well known, the Greeks, this is a little after the early civilization period, but not that much after, the Greeks developed an elaborate notion that people who weren't Greek were barbarians. The word came from the sounds Greeks thought foreign people made, bar, 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 and from that barbarian. Chinese notoriously viewed other peoples, both in civilizations and out, as barbarians. Okay, so it's quite valid to note that civilizations tend to produce people, particularly city people, who will look down on others and invent nasty terms for them. And we can note that. It's an interesting human phenomenon, but it's really, really important as part of a world history approach not to adopt those kinds of prejudices in looking at the differences between civilized and uncivilized peoples. People without civilizations, without the organizational apparatus which we're focusing on for civilization, people without civilizations can have elaborate rules of conduct. They can be politer than people in civilizations. They can treat old people better than some civilized peoples do. They can fight less and engage in much more careful delimitation of war than civilized peoples do. So I think it's obvious, but it's actually quite important because it's sort of hard to get this out of one's head. The normal connotation of a barbarian, you know, hairy, nose-picking, unregulated, just doesn't work. Because some of those people will crop up in civilizations too, and people who weren't in civilizations don't necessarily fall into that category. The final concern about the civilization concept, and this really is important for civilizations themselves, is to recognize that what we emphasize in civilizations can distort aspects of the human experience and the kinds of groups that form civilizations. Take an obvious example. We've mentioned that civilizations, with perhaps a couple of exceptions, always involve writing. And I think that's valid. Writing is important. It does change the way states operate, trade operates, knowledge gathering operates. But until very recently, the vast majority of people in civilizations were illiterate. So writing is there. It affects the way the society is conducted, but it does not describe the majority condition. We've emphasized cities, but remember from the discussion of agriculture that all agricultural civilizations had at most a fairly small minority of the total population living in cities. Most people were rural, and many rural people encountered the apparatus of civilization mainly in terms of tax collectors and military recruiters, and frankly, many of them otherwise would have been just as happy had civilization not existed. So, civilization is a valid concept if it is delimited by the recognition, A, it doesn't spread everywhere, and particularly in this several millennia early civilization period, doesn't spread to most parts of the inhabited world. Second, it's not necessarily more civilized than the barbarians, if we use civilized in the sense of refined behavior, control, etc. It may or may not be. And above all, third, it does not necessarily, its leading characteristics don't necessarily describe many of the ways in which most of the people in civilizations lived. And this in turn reminds us, final point, that civilizations, like any major human development, such as agriculture, civilizations involve a mixture of advantages and disadvantages. Civilizations almost certainly increased inequality above the levels that agricultural economies had already introduced. Civilizations, by writing rules and laws like occurred in Mesopotamia, civilizations formalize at least the inequality between men and women. Civilizations usually develop a more extensive social structure for men and women both, between the upper classes associated with politics and religion and the lower classes associated with rural manufacture and sometimes slavery. Civilizations tend disproportionately to benefit those who manage to find themselves in the upper classes. The benefits for other groups of people are less certain and in some ways much less obvious. Many civilizations, finally, and we've already implied this, extend the capacity for warfare beyond what hunting and gathering and agricultural peoples had done, and also by attracting invasions and pressure from the outside, may increase the importance of military activity and the disadvantages of military activity for ordinary people as well. All right. Civilization, as it actually emerged in the early civilization period, also has a second meaning, and we now turn to this one. Civilization first is a form of human organization, cities, states, writing, etc. Civilization in this second meaning involves particular characteristics in certain regions that will be partially different from the characteristics of the civilization one region over. In other words, the second definition of civilization involves the identification of some cohesive cultural and institutional systems that mark one case off from the next, at least in part. A couple of examples from the early civilization period. Mesopotamian and Egyptian civilizations developed close beside each other geographically. They had periods of exchange. There were a few occasions where Egyptian armies pressed into parts of the Middle East, a few occasions where Middle Eastern invaders pressed down into Egypt. There was certainly trade. There seems probably to have been some cultural exchange. There are stones in which Egyptian and Middle Eastern languages are placed side by side, which suggests that there was some need and effort to translate. So these were societies growing up in some proximity and in some contact, but they were quite different. Egyptian society, and this is pretty familiar stuff, Egyptian society emphasized monuments more elaborately than Mesopotamian society did. These monuments reflected a somewhat different capacity to organize labor. They also clearly reflected different beliefs about the afterlife and the appropriate response to death. Egyptian culture, including its artistic forms and the literary forms that remain, seems to have been, on the whole, somewhat cheerier than Mesopotamian culture. Mesopotamian culture, and we know this from great epics, the first great literary piece in world history that we know of, great epics such as the Gilgamesh, Mesopotamian culture seems to have had a slightly gloomier cast, less confidence that after death one could ascend to a superior afterlife. The two societies treated women differently. They were both patriarchal. They fit the basic definition. But Egyptian society seems, at least in the upper classes, to have allowed greater leeway for women. There were important women rulers and consorts in Egyptian history. Women are depicted with greater care in Egyptian art. Children were treated differently, and I must confess I wish I knew for sure why. Egypt was a very unusual early civilization in that it did not seem to have practiced infanticide. That is, the deliberate killing of young children as a means of population control, both for individual families and for society as a whole. Most early civilizations, and possibly other societies as well, practiced infanticide often quite widely. This was certainly the case in Mesopotamia, but Egypt seems not to have done it, as travelers from the Middle East and Southeastern Europe noted. So you have here obviously an invitation to comparison, which is one of the things we do with civilizations once they come into our vocabulary, but also an interesting attestation to the extent to which civilizations in this second meaning, even civilizations that were quite close to each other, could develop separate lines of activity, separate cultural definitions, separate kinds of political institutions. Egypt was obviously much more consistently politically centralized, much less subject to invasion than was Mesopotamian civilization. So the comparative emphasis here highlights civilization as a regionally cohesive force. The same applies to the other early River Valley civilizations.